sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Shalom Friedman, Israeli author, poet, and thinker. We'll also have visits from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. As Jews, we are always interested in the sources of our people's vitality over the 3,800 years of our existence. And for about 2,000 years, the principal source of life, learning, and community has been the synagogue, whether it's called temple, congregation, shul, or kehillah. It is that place that has guaranteed Judaism will survive and thrive from one generation to the next. You know, we have a great deal of literary information about the central shrines of our people in ancient days, the first and second temples in Jerusalem and their predecessor, the tabernacle in the wilderness. The Torah gives us elaborate instruction on how the great tent of worship and meeting was made and used, even how it was carried from place to place and who carried it. And the Book of Kings and the writings of the prophets in the Hebrew Bible tell us much about the functioning of the first temple in Jerusalem, Solomon's fabulous temple with its magnificence and holiness. And the second temple after the destruction of the first is well documented too in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah in the Bible. The structure and rituals of that magnificent edifice are elaborately and lovingly described in the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Talmud, and in many stories and legends. But long before the destruction of the last great temple in Jerusalem, back in the year 70 by the Romans, we Jews had begun meeting and praying and studying and arguing together in a new institution called a synagogue, a Beit Tfilah or a Beit Knesset, a place for less elaborate ritual but greater intimacy, a place of intellectual stimulation, of personal expression, a place for true community. So, what and when were the first synagogue? There is some clue in the name itself. It's a Greek word. It means house of assembly, the same thing as the Hebrew phrase for synagogue, Beit Knesset. Most people believe that the oldest surviving synagogue site that has been discovered so far is actually on a Greek island. Now, as you regular listeners to Two Jewish know, a couple of weeks ago, my wife Wendy and I returned from our summer vacation on a cruise to Europe. I filled you in on a lot of that trip last week, but saved a bit of the best for today. After all, when I find extraordinary Jewish life and history in far-flung places, the least I could do is share it with you, my faithful and devoted Two Jewish Radio Show audience. By the way, if you want to hear last week's show, go to twojewishradio.com and download it or podcast us on iTunes. For the best deal of all, absolutely free, thanks to our wonderful sponsors. In any case, one of the most interesting places we visited was the island of Delos, near Mykonos in the Cyclades, islands of the Aegean Sea, about 100 nautical miles from Athens, a day's journey by sea today, but probably 2 or 3 days in ancient times. Delos has several distinctions. First, it was one of the most important pagan shrines in antiquity, a center for the worship of the multiple gods of that day for 1,000 years before the ancient Greeks decided that Delos was the true birthplace of the major gods Apollo, the sun god, and his twin sister Artemis, the moon goddess. Delos was later the center of the Delian League, an important alliance led by Athens, including a huge treasury and a big merchant presence. It was a major port city and the banking and commercial center of the Mediterranean world for about a century. And Delos is also a beautiful little island and an extraordinary ruin today, still being excavated, with many fascinating mansions, temples, sacred places, fountains, statues, mosaics, and large commercial areas. But for us, finally, Delos is likely the location of the oldest synagogue ever found. What makes this exceptionally interesting is that in its heyday, the island of Delos was one of the 2 or 3 most important pagan worship centers in the world. And yet, on the same island that worshippers of Apollo and Dionysus took as the centers of their cults, the very same island that received thousands of offerings of statues and temples to pagan gods, the very first synagogue in history was built. You know, it's a little bit like finding the first shul ever created inside the Vatican, or the oldest temple located next to the Kaaba in Mecca. This Delos Synagogue is located in a residential area of the island, a good walk from the big public central avenue filled with temples and sacred lakes and sacred harbors and statues and such. Still, it's a unique reminder that Jewish practice and study, as we know them, really began in a setting dominated by another culture and religion, and that we have always flourished in close juxtaposition to other beliefs and practices. On this beautiful little Greek island, overlooking the deep blue waters of the Aegean, 200 years before the last temple was destroyed and the long exile from Israel began, there in Delos, Jewish worship and study started on the path that it remains on today. An extraordinary place for a remarkable beginning. You know, I suppose it's a bit too obvious to note that the magnificent pagan temples and the gorgeous shrines to Apollo and Artemis and Dionysus lie in ruins now, and that no one has worshipped these gods for perhaps 1,500 years. But that small synagogue has endured, and the values, traditions, and meaning it represented continue to make it the most important institution in the Jewish world, and perhaps in this whole complicated world. So to play us in this morning in the spirit of the Jews of the Aegean, here's the song No Pasa Por Ala Mi Puerta, a playful tune from the Jews of Salonika, Greece, inviting passers-by not to pass by, but to stop and view the singer's beautiful, marriageable daughter and handsome and also marriageable son.
No pases por la mi puerta, no pases por la mi puerta, que tengo hija galana y pasaré. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. No paséis por mi cortijo, no paséis por mi cortijo, que tengo y yo garido y pasaré. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Si tenéis hijo garido, si tenéis hijo garido, dámelo a mí por marido y pasaré. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Pases por la mi puerta, no pases por la mi puerta, que tengo hija galana y pasaré. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey. Pasaré y tornaré, le hablaré y le diré que la vía no es suyo, es del rey.
That was from the group The Voice of the Turtle, the fine Sephardic vocal and instrumental ensemble. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, I'll fill you in on what Shabbat is like in the great synagogue in Rome these days, and we'll meet our guest, intellectual, author, poet, and thinker on spiritual matters, the fascinating Shalom Friedman, who will explain what the Ruach HaKodesh, the Spirit of God, has to do with the survival of the State of Israel. All that when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. Do you ever say to yourself, I just don't know what I feel like eating? You know you're hungry, but for what? Of course, I could try to tempt you with a Mama's Pizza. It's got mountains of fresh cheese, acres of sauce, and a crust that's so flavorful. Yes, a Mama's Pizza is always tempting, especially when you think about its aroma just as it's ready to come out of the oven. And what can you say about our toppings? How about meaty, crunchy, spicy, fresh, flavorful, delicious? There's no doubt when your mind is unsure about what your stomach is craving, hearing about a hot, fresh Mama's Pizza might just help you decide. But I'm out of time, so I guess I'll have to wait until later to give you the details about the delicious cheesiness and tantalizing nature of our hot, fresh pizza. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics, infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning, Shalom Friedman, an Israeli-American writer, thinker, poet, and public intellectual, which is something all rabbis aspire to and almost none achieve. A Jewish writer, his best-known work is Conversations with Thinkers and Religious Leaders and Spiritual Leaders, focusing on the concept of service to God. His work has touched on a very wide variety of issues, not only about Israel and Israel's struggle, but the human condition, which I think all great writers deal with, and what it means to be a Jew in this century and maybe every century. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You became a Balchi. Well, I guess I want to start with how you came to Israel, which was just after the Yom Kippur War, 1974. I have cousins that moved there at the same time. Might have been the worst possible time to make Aliyah in the history of the whole Israeli experience. Why did you decide to come to Israel then?
I felt very strongly during the Yom Kippur War the threat to the existence and the survival of Israel. All of us in my generation are so strongly influenced by the Shoah, the Holocaust, and the sense of the possible destruction once again of the Jewish people. And I was living in America, and I enjoyed America. I love America. But I thought, where could I possibly make a real contribution in some way? And so I made Aliyah to Israel. I'm happy to say that in this more than 30 years here, I don't know if my contribution is very great, but I feel that being here and having a family here and living every day here has realized my dream in some way.
The dream of Israel has been at the heart of the Jewish experience in a religious sense. Tell me what you mean by spiritual as opposed to religious.
Well, for me, spiritual, which is has become the popular word in the past 20 years, I don't distinguish the two. I was raised in a nominally, what's called a nominally Orthodox family in Troy, New York. My Bubby and Zadie came from the shtetl. They came from Eastern Europe, from Lomža, from Suwalk, from both sides. And I very well remember the whole Jewish experience of that Yiddish-speaking world. I remember the second generation in America. So I have a very strong sense of Jewish religious life. We were there were 500 Jewish families in Troy, but we were a small community, and we had that experience of being Jewish at home and being outside of the home, blending in with the general public. When I came to Israel, it was a slow process, and I was helped by a couple of wonderful rabbis. One was, they're both unfortunately passed away, Rabbi Chaim Perl and Rabbi Eliyahu Barnes, who brought me into the whole world of Jewish prayer, which I love so much. And they brought me back. And so if I, in America, I was more distant from religion, slowly, slowly, in Israel, I've returned and feel that this has given me a meaning in life that otherwise would have been very much lacking.
We will talk much more with our guest this morning on Two Jewish, Shalom Friedman, thinker, writer, poet, and I guess expert on the spiritual connection between the Jewish people and Israel and God, when we come back in just a few moments.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism of Kvetch or Kfell, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear past and present shows through our website or downloading us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. You know, I have one last trip memory from our recent jaunt to the Mediterranean. It comes from attending Shabbat services in Rome, a fascinating and beautiful Friday night service. The great synagogue there, right in the ghetto across from the Tiber River, is gorgeous. A big 19th century building in the Moorish style. They deliberately wanted something that didn't look like all those Renaissance and Baroque churches and cathedrals in Rome. The building is light and airy. Well, actually, it was pretty warm on this summer night, but it looks light and airy. And the regular congregants form a kind of choir that sits near the front and sings much of the service in the pretty Nusach Roma melodies that are heard only in Italian synagogues. The music was done beautifully, alternating between the cantor at the front of the congregation and the lay singers in the front pews. It is one of the oldest Jewish musical traditions, perhaps going back to the Roman Jewish community of the first century BCE, and it was wonderful to be able to sing along with them at the great synagogue in Rome. Quite a musical and enjoyable Shabbat in every way. And then we walked out into a gorgeous Roman sunset. You know, sometimes it's good to be a Jew.
We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Good morning, Rabbi.
Moker Tov. We've been talking about the Israel Defense Forces, the military, the primary social glue of Israeli society. You know, people in America know that women are involved in the military, serve in the military. Men are all drafted. How much do women have to serve? How many women choose to serve?
Well, generally, all women are supposed to serve in Israel. They serve for 2 years. It's a year and 8 months, 10 months, but nearly 2 years. If they want to volunteer and serve in combat units in positions that are equal to men, they're required to sign for the extra months and serve the same time as
men.
Which
is 3 years for guys.
Which is 3 years for men. Men actually serve 3 years, but later on serve in the reserve forces for another 20 years, between 2 weeks to 1 month a year.
And that's every year in the Miluim, everybody in the same unit that they serve in active duty usually.
Usually, yes. It creates this bonding, this connection. People come from different social backgrounds, but once a year they meet and
they can come together from anywhere in Israel. You know, you can have a unit with people from Haifa and Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Sderot or wherever, anywhere in Israel.
Exactly. Now, regarding women, women that define themselves as religion are excluded, or as observant religion, are excluded from military service if they want to be excluded. Most of the girls that choose to be excluded later on go and volunteer in social programs, Shirut Leumi, across city, helping with education and stuff like that. Those are usually the more orthodox girls that don't feel comfortable about getting commands from a male commander, for instance, or stuff like that.
So this National Service, Shirut Leumi, what does that consist of?
Shirut Leumi is a nationwide program that allows people to volunteer through different areas of community service. Helping with education system, helping in hospitals, helping with kindergartens, helping in libraries, a lot of programs, helping with youth movements, with older people, and those sort of stuff.
There's no real bias against people that choose Shirut Leumi instead of serving active service in the IDF, is there? Is there a sense, oh, they should have served actively, or is it okay?
Well, I don't think there is a real bias. I do think that some people in this society do appreciate more serving in the military. It does seem to be that it's not only that your contribution is larger when you serve in the army, but also you kind of pay a bigger price, which makes society feel that we need to honor you more.
You've shown more dedication to Israel.
Right, and it goes also within the army. If you serve in a unit that is a frontline unit, a combat unit, you take more risks and harder service, that, to my personal perspective, you should be honored more than someone that sat in a back office in Haifa and did a great job, but didn't really put as much efforts at risk. That's my thought.
As someone on the front lines.
Yeah.
Thanks, Guy. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, whom we saw in Rome, by the way, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Weiler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So what's going on this summer at Janos and the J-Bar?
We've got so much going on, it's hard for me to keep it all straight, but I'm going to try. We've got our summer music series that you know about. We have our summer passports where you dine, and the more times you dine, you collect stamps for free dinners at Janos or J-Bar. Our Janos summer samplers at $19.95, our J-Bar summer samplers at $12.95. At Janos, our 10 terrific taste menu, four courses, 12 different items for $50, drink specials, wine specials. Summer's our time.
I'm starving.
Well, come on over, Rabbi.
What's the phone number for Janos and the J-Bar?
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com. We've got all our menus up. We've got the summer music schedule up.
And don't forget all the great samplers. We will see you at Janos on the J-Bar, J-A-N-O-S.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, back from a variety of travels. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, you went to one of your favorite places, Thessaloniki in Greece, and had an interesting story from there.
Yeah, actually, I went to a number of places, and one of them I was lucky enough to have dinner with you and your lovely wife.
You did.
That was a special treat.
Top of a hotel in Rome on a Friday night
right
after Shabbat services.
But yeah, I was in Thessaloniki, where I have a long-standing friendship with some of the leaders of the Jewish community. And as we've talked about before, it's one of the few major cities in Europe, if not in the world, outside of the land of Israel, which for many centuries was more than 50% Jewish. It was a Jewish majority, and our people were not a minority. And this was mostly in the Ottoman years, but also to some extent after Greek independence. In any case, this story did not take place while I was there, but shortly after I left. There is, in almost the exact center of Thessaloniki, there is a square from which Jews were deported to Auschwitz during the Holocaust. And in that square is a very moving sculpture, which is one of the most unique sculptures commemorating the Holocaust that I've ever seen. And it looks like a menorah, but the flames are like human beings twisted in agony. And it's quite striking and very large. And at the base of it was, in the past, a single plaque. And then the president of Israel came to visit at some point within the last 10 or 15 years. And they moved one plaque, the existing plaque, to the right, and they put a new plaque to the left in Hebrew, English, and Greek, saying that the president of Israel had made a special visit to Thessaloniki to acknowledge the importance of the history of the Jewish community. Obviously, the government in Athens doesn't like this because it likes to treat Thessaloniki as if it doesn't exist. And in fact, until 1912, Thessaloniki was part of Turkey.
Sonica.
Right. So, in any case, very recently, some right-wing extremists, Greeks, who were seeking to blame the Jews or the international Jewish community or the international banking Jewish cabal or whatever, because there are very few Jews left in Greece, for the current economic crisis in Greece, which is really related to Greece's decision to join the Eurozone when it wasn't ready for it. But in any case, these right-wing extremists tried to deface the memorial at the same time as a group of French tourists were visiting. The French tourists tried by force to stop the desecration of this memorial, and the police came along and arrested both sides. They carted them off, the French tourists and the homegrown extremists, but they very quickly let the French tourists go and retained the homegrown extremists. So, I mean, I think one of the conclusions you can reach from this is that wingnuts anywhere will blame a convenient minority, even if the convenient minority could have absolutely nothing to do with the problem or very, very little to do with the problem. And I think we see this not only all over Europe, but all over the world.
Yeah, certainly. That's been my experience all over the United States and elsewhere. Well, at least they got the right people jailed eventually. And we can talk more about some of the other interesting trends in Europe and the world when we talk next week.
I look forward to it.
Nice to see you back here, Tom. Thanks.
Thanks.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Mm-hmm.
Judy bumps into her friend Esther and immediately says, "I've just heard you got married, Esther. I'm so happy for you. But tell me, was it love at first sight?" "Oh, no, Judy. It was love at second sight," replies Esther. "At first sight, there was no way to know that Harry was a multimillionaire." That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special feature, Too Jewish Just for You. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, Maaseh, includes the final chapters of the Book of Numbers. In this concluding section of Bamidbar, an important and unusual institution is created, the City of Refuge. In the days before police forces and criminal courts were common, justice in cases of manslaughter or murder was typically accomplished by the family of the victim. What we would consider vigilante action was the normal means to address the moral and social disruption created by killing. If you killed someone, intentionally or accidentally, or even if the family of a person who was killed thought you had done the killing, you would likely be killed by their kinsmen. It was like the Hatfields and McCoys. Kill and you will be killed, and then your family will avenge the killing and the other family will respond, and on it would go. That meant that if you were involved in such a terrible situation, you had very little chance to stay alive, even if the killing was accidental, even, in fact, if you were innocent. The wheels of justice might turn for you eventually, but if you were already dead in a revenge killing, it wouldn't help. And so, in our portion of Maaseh, the Torah provides for 6 cities of refuge to be created in and around the land of Israel. No person who enters these cities may be executed without fair trial. Being present in the city of refuge is a kind of protection, the guarantee of due process that has become central in modern law, but was mostly absent throughout human history until recently. And yet the Torah established that principle some 3,000 years ago or so. Perhaps even more importantly, in this section of Maaseh, the central requirement to try a capital case in Jewish law is established. A murderer may not be put to death save by the eyewitness testimony of 2 adult witnesses. This is a much more stringent standard than used by any death penalty court in America today. Murder, the deliberate taking of human life, is the most serious of crimes and must be fully punished. But that punishment can only be meted out after a careful process of justice. The use of lynch mobs is outmaneuvered in the Torah by the creation of these cities of refuge. Proper witnesses must be secured to give evidence. A trial of law before appropriately qualified judges must be instituted before any punishment for murder can be applied. While halacha, Jewish law, provides for the death penalty in cases of premeditated murder, it makes it extremely difficult to enforce that punishment. The Mishnah in Makot teaches that a court that passes a death penalty once in 7 years is considered bloodthirsty. Other prominent rabbis extend that to once in 70 years or ever. In other words, the ultimate punishment, capital punishment, must be reserved for a nearly perfect case. Otherwise, only lesser forms of remediation can be applied, and since we are human, our cases are usually far less than perfect. Jewish law makes it clear that justice, especially for the worst crimes, must be careful, exacting, and scrupulously ethical. Would that it were always so, even today. When we come back on Too Jewish, the unique and creative public intellectual Shalom Friedman will tell us how the ethical teachings of the Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik have influenced his poetry and his remarkable understanding of the essence of Jewish peoplehood. All that when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174.
Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Good news. Jerusalem and Tel Aviv were ranked among the world's best cities by the New York-based Travel and Leisure magazine. Jerusalem was ranked in second place, followed by Tel Aviv in third in the Middle East and Africa category of the magazine's best city listing. Cape Town beat them both out in first, with Cairo and Dubai fourth and fifth. The lists come from a reader's survey. The monthly magazine has more than a million subscribers. According to Israel's Ministry of Tourism, during the first half of 2010, 76% of tourists in Israel went to Jerusalem, visiting the Western Wall, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Via Dolorosa, Yad Vashem, and so on. Tel Aviv, known for its nightlife and proximity to the beach, gets about 54% of the tourists in Israel. That raises some interesting questions. Only 76% of tourists to Israel go to Jerusalem? And only 54% go to Tel Aviv? What the heck are they visiting? I mean, Eilat is a nice beach town, the Sea of Galilee is a pretty lake, Haifa's a neat city, but if you go to Israel, aren't you inevitably going to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv? Clearly I'm missing something here. Well, please call or email me at twojewishradio@yahoo.com and tell me what I'm missing. And the latest attempt at a flotilla-type public relations invasion of Israel evaporated last week when the activists aboard the lone Gaza-bound flotilla ship were intercepted by Israel and deported. Some 15 activists, journalists, and crew members were deported last Wednesday, a day after the French flag Dignity al-Karama was boarded by Israeli commandos near Gaza and towed to Israel's Ashdod port. One activist was an Israeli journalist. He was not deported. The ship reportedly declared a port in Egypt as its final destination in order to leave Greek waters. At least seven other flotilla ships were detained and remain in Greek ports for safety violations. The Dignity was carrying about 10 French and Greek activists, as well as three journalists and three crew members. After boarding the ship, Israeli troops checked the condition of the passengers and offered them food and drink. Passengers were then turned over to officials from the Israel Police, the Immigration and Population Authority, and the Misrad HaPnim, the Interior Ministry. They could be denied entrance back to Israel for the next 10 years since they are being deported. And in a catch-up story from late June, the Dutch parliament has voted to approve a ban on kosher and halal slaughter after intense lobbying by animal rights groups. The Netherlands Senate must now vote on the measure, which will take place probably in September. The Dutch Party for Animals, first group of its kind to win seats in a national parliament in Europe, has been lobbying to close a loophole in Dutch law that gives Jews and Muslims permission to kill an animal without stunning. Binyamin Jacobs, the country's chief rabbi, has compared the ban to anti-Semitic laws enacted by the Nazis during their occupation that led to the death of 104,000 Dutch Jews in the Holocaust. One of the first measures taken during the occupation was closing the kosher abattoirs, he said. The very fact that there's a discussion about this is very painful for the Dutch Jewish community. Those who survived the war remember the very first law made by the Germans in Holland was banning the Jewish way of slaughtering animals. Dutch Muslims have also complained they feel stigmatized amid growing support for Geert Wilders, the anti-Islamic populist whose Freedom Party supports the ban. There was no reason for passing this law, said Imam Mahmoud of the Al-Tawid Mosque. It's a political decision. Who has the authority to determine whether the way of killing animals is good or not? Sweden, Luxembourg, and non-EU members Norway and Switzerland ban ritual slaughter, but the EU, which bans the killing of non-stunned animals, does allow religious exceptions. Chief British Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks had traveled to the Netherlands to try to lobby against the law, and Abe Foxman, national director of the U.S. Anti-Defamation League and a recent guest on Too Jewish, said the ban was a repudiation of the Netherlands' historic commitment to religious freedom. Dutch Jews must not be put to the choice of violating a central tenet of Judaism, foregoing fresh kosher meat, or emigrating. We call upon the Dutch Senate to prevent this action from leading to a clear violation of religious freedom that has a disproportionate impact on the Jewish community.
The Conference of European Rabbis agreed. They said the decision was an outrage. Their president, Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, said the practical effects of this bill mean that Jews are no longer welcome in the Netherlands. This has not happened for 70 years, meaning since the Nazis. Well, we'll see if the Dutch complete this crossing of the Kashrut Rubicon. If so, it is a sad situation indeed. By the way, hunting animals is still legal in Holland. That is surely a much crueler way than the quick death given by Schieten, kosher ritual slaughter. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Sholom Friedman, an American-born Israeli writer, thinker, poet, and public intellectual. I have to ask, from this you make a living?
Well, I've worked for many years as a translator and editor, and it's not so easy, but somehow I've gotten through it all. I haven't become a millionaire.
I want to mention he has written a number of books: Small Acts of Kindness, Striving for Derech Eretz in Everyday Life, With Yitz Greenberg, Living in the Image of God, Jewish Teachings to Perfect the World, and a number of other books about God and Jerusalem and living in Israel. You have written that Jews are a people who dwell alone. The great creators too dwell alone, as God was alone in creating the world. Sometimes Israel seems like it's alone in the world.
Well, I felt that very, very strongly. We all felt it strongly at various times. There was the Zionism and racism resolution in the 70s, and I remember that here, which fortunately was repealed. Jewish people have a lot of non-Jewish great friends. One of them, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, was instrumental in that. However, today I feel the situation has gotten much, much worse. The campaign of delegitimizing Israel in the world has grown in such a way, and at the heart of it is a whole misperception of the Jewish people and Israel. Without becoming over political, I just would like to second one major point which bothers me all the time. The people of Israel want peace. The great majority of the people of Israel are willing to make sacrifices for peace. All the problem which has existed from 1947-48, even back in the 20s, through the offers, the generous offers made by Prime Minister Barak and Prime Minister Olmert, is that the other side does not want peace. We can't make peace with ourselves. We are willing, and the fact of the world, that the world has turned so much against Israel, and the only democratic society in the Middle East is accused of those very crimes which our enemies perpetuate every day in the media. And it's a worrisome situation. We could talk about the geopolitical changes, what's happened in Turkey, what's happened in Egypt, but it's a long story. But I just would stress so much how much the people of Israel feel they need the support of American Jews. And the call for unity, which when I came to Israel in 74 and which I remember in 67, it's even stronger today. We need the real support of the American Jewish community.
Tell me what it means to be a religious Jew today and how you think the huge chasm that seems to have developed between religious and so-called secular Jews can be bridged.
Well, there's a great rabbi in Israel by the name of Daniel Troper, and he has an organization called Gesher, and which he has been working on this problem for years, and it's not an easy problem. And don't forget that the religious world itself is complex and divided. There is a division in the religious world between religious Zionist Jews and Haredi Jews, and they see the world very, very differently. And we need a lot of different bridges. between different people. And we need bridges which will make us feel, will enable us to be tolerant of one another and enable us to live in harmony, in peace. And often that's done by living in separate areas. It's not necessarily through blending and integration, but it's a priority. It's a tremendous priority. I just say one more word about religious and spiritual connection. I had a wonderful teacher. His name was Chaim David Herzberg. He was a man who every person he met and spoke with, he made them feel better about himself. He used to say, "Mitzvah gedola liot besimcha tamid." It's a great, great commandment to be in joy all the time. Well, no one can really live by that. But he reflected that. He radiated that. And he gave it to so many people. And I think if we can greet each person we meet and have a general attitude, a loving, kind, sever panim yafot, a beautiful countenance toward others, of Jew and Gentile alike, it will be better for us and better for the world.
You wrote something that I think describes how so many Jews see everything. The future before us seems on the one hand incredibly open and vast, and on the other determined to end in ultimate disaster. That's Judaism, right? Everything is possible. God is all-powerful. But for sure, there's Cossacks coming around the corner. Can you explain that? Maybe amplify that a little for us?
Well, nevuah, or prophecy, is given to fools, and I'm not a prophet. Maybe I'm a bit of a fool, but
I don't know. But Lo Navi Velo Ben Navi is a good one, too, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not a prophet, not the son of a prophet.
I just think that if we take it outside simply the Jewish perspective, the world today, it has so many problems in terms of ecology, environment, nuclear proliferation, which is a tremendous danger to Israel, but it's also a tremendous danger to the world. If Iran attains nuclear weapons and they're increasing the range of their missiles, they're already in range of Europe, they'll soon be in range of the United States. Well, these people, with their kind of ideology, which is at least one major strain, is fanatical and suicidal. It's a tremendous worry. So when we think about disaster scenarios, and if this interview is going to be aired on the period of Bein HaMetzarim, between the Straits, the Jewish people have known disaster in the past. And having known disaster in the past, as any trauma doctor will tell you, you think of that disaster as a possibility in the future in a strong way. And mankind has known disaster in the past. So I hope, and this is really a word in relation to the United States and its predominant place in the world representing freedom, I just hope that those forces, the forces of light, however problematic they are, however imperfect they are, will in some way prevail over forces which are working in a different way.
You have become a poet. Maybe you were always a poet. Mostly you do poetry now. Could you share a poem with us?
Oh, I'd be very happy to. Many people ask me the question, what is a Jewish poem? So I thought I would write a small poem about what is a Jewish poem. What is a Jewish poem? Shema is a Jewish poem, perhaps the Jewish poem. Shmona Esrei is comprised of Jewish poems. 19 prayers is one. Our history is filled with Jewish poems, from the beginning with Abraham and Sarah, those who have given so much beyond our understanding. Jewish poems are everywhere. Is each Jewish life a poem and a story also? Or is it only those who give something to our people in history who are worthy of poetry? I have known many Jewish poems. People the great world will not know the names of. People who, whether they walked humbly or not, made the lives of others better in some way. Kindness is perhaps the ultimate Jewish poem, and justice also. And Jewish poems are not without their contradictions. As I write this poem in Jerusalem in the land of Israel, I think of the small Jewish world of Troy, New York, where I came from so many years ago, and miss so many people, no longer of that and this world. Longing for Israel for 2,000 years was the Jewish poem. Living here now is a blessing and a gift I thank God for.
It's beautiful. I want to thank Shalom Friedman for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. You can find his poems online at poemhunter.com. Shalom, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. It's been a great pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, to find balance in life is to find happiness. Now, I assume he was a smart guy being a philosopher and all, so it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this, what one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese, heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce, crispy crust or lightly done crust. It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Rabbi Mary Zamor, author of the new book about Jewish ethical eating, The Sacred Table. Our playout this morning comes from the Sons of Sfarad and their song, Fel Shara. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
El Shara can petit masha, la signorina ojos y un mal, come la luna e per la sua faccia, di eclere lo boulevard. Come la luna e per la sua faccia, di eclere lo boulevard. Hallelujah, Palyanu Kohokeri. And if you want the Hallelujah, Palyanu Kohokeri.